Welcome to Pap Talk, a podcast from Contemporary OBGYN, where we deliver expert insight, commentary, and more on emerging topics and trends to doctors in women's health.
Welcome to this online discussion. I'm happy to have with me Dr. Rob Zerwin and Gabby Moavad to talk about robotic technology and basically where we are currently and where we are going. One of the interesting additions to robotic technology that has been in development and still is in development and not FDA approved is a vaginal robot, the hominous robot technology. And it was interesting to me to kind of discuss a little bit how that would fit into clinical practice once it is allowed or has been allowed to be used here in the US or elsewhere, and also where sort of robotic technology is going, where does it fit into clinical practice, both these systems and also what other systems are coming down the pike, how does cost come into this, how does training come into this. So those are sort of the things that we wanted to talk about, and maybe initially wanted to for you guys to comment on where does robotic surgery stand today, and maybe talk a little bit about sort of where it has, you know, how it has come to where it is now, you know, a brief sort of recap. So maybe you guys can take that and run with that a little bit.
Well, let me jump in for a second, because Gabby is really at the forefront of robotic surgery in many other areas. But you wanted to address the vaginal approach. And this really speaks to the greatest unmet need of GYN surgery, because every single GYN organization recommends vaginal hysterectomy as the preferred method of hysterectomy. But the needle hasn't moved past maybe 15 or 16% forever. And they can say whatever they want, but the reason for that is anatomy, is surgical training and discomfort with surgeons who are coming through training and even existing surgeons with performing vaginal surgery, because the key to it rests in a dissection into the anterior posterior cul-de-sac, security with a feeling of security with the vessels, and avoiding the bladder and the rectum. And this is really, if not been unchanged, has actually gotten worse, because the world of vaginal surgery now is out of the hands of the generalists, and now in the urogynecologists and some of the oncologists, and of course, specifically trained minimally invasive surgeries, MIGS fellowship trained surgeons. Mm-hmm. So how can you possibly have vaginal hysterectomy as the preferred method of hysterectomy if nobody knows how to do it? And one of the challenges is the anatomy, but also, if you remember back in the day when we were all in training, cesarean section was only a small percentage of deliveries, and now it's anywhere from 30 to 50 to 70%, depending on where you are. And so once you do that, you have an increased risk of scarring in the anterior cul-de-sac. So in addition to just getting into a simple anterior cul-de-sac, now you got to dig through that. Now, a number of publications have shown the feasibility of vag hist after C-section, but it still is keeping people away. So if you asked about the vaginal robot, this was an opportunity to combine robotic surgery with a laparoscopic view and a vaginal single incision approach. And one of the advantages of that is that the entry is guided by a small laparoscopic scope, umbilical scope, and then it monitors the entry of the trocar through the posterior cul-de-sac. So you're not going to hit anything. It's direct visualization. And then once it's in, the arms retroflex, and you can dissect off the bladder. Under direct visual guidance, you can do the surgery, also at nexal surgery, and then remove the specimen through the colpotomy you made for the trocar. So it kind of combines all those steps. Not that it's... And so I think that this is one of the modalities. Other robotic platforms have attempted vaginal surgery and run into the same problem. There are a lot of excellent surgeons doing V-notes, which is, of course, a very nice modality. But again, you have to get into the anterior and posterior cul-de-sac before you put in the gel point. And after you do that, you might as well put a couple of clamps on the uterine vessels and you're done. There you go. I just wanted to give a little background on the vaginal approach. Of course, hominids is still awaiting FDA approval, but it's moving down the road. And I wanted to give that introduction before we talk about more about the robotics in general. And I know that Gabi's done a lot of tremendous work on not only cost, but training. And so I'd just like to turn it over to him.
These are all really great point that you brought in, and we can start seeing why the value of robotic surgery would be beneficial in moving the needle towards V-nodes or robotic V-nodes. It's in addition to what you said, the important thing is the robotic platform is enabling the surgeon to be in control of the visualization as well, all the arm, minimizing the use of an assistant, which it was always a struggle when we did in the days vaginal hysterectomy, where we have the learners and the surgeon and the assistant all not being able to see appropriately the important structure to spare, like the ureters in vaginal hysterectomy or other landmarks. And that was, I believe, one of the drawbacks of vaginal surgery is whenever we get into difficult case, in addition to the type of pelvis, the body mass index of the patient, we tend to veer away. Now add to that the more complexity of benign GYN surgery, including endometriosis. And the problem with the endometriosis, let's say, is that there are a lot of surgeons not being able to diagnose obliterated cul-de-sac or having the tools to diagnose that beforehand of the surgery. And many of the rectovaginal endometriosis in the with the general OBGYN is diagnosed by accident intraoperatively. So imagine now we're trying to push V-nodes or vaginal surgery to a wide variety of less experienced surgeon, thinking that this is the primary approach without good safety tools that can help them to or enable them to proceed with vaginal surgery as a primary approach. Now, here I'm going to play the devil's advocate a little bit, maybe to open a little bit more the discussion, which is knowing that now most of the surgery are done laparoscopically or robotically or minimally invasive, let's say. What, in your opinion, and I want to hear everybody's opinion in that sense, the V-nodes could add to this safe laparoscopic surgery, especially now we're moving to less ports, more micro ports to minimize the injury or the trauma to the abdominal wall cavity. Dr. Einarsson or Zerwin could comment on this.
Well, I mean, from my perspective, and this is obviously my biased perspective, I like to see what I'm doing. And I remember, in residency, when I graduated, I did my residency with Dr. Zerwin, actually. And we did a lot of vaginal hysterectomies at that time. I think I graduated with probably 50 or 60 of them and felt very comfortable. And so when I got out, I felt very strongly that I should be able to do all of these things and offer all of these modalities to my patients. But then gradually just realized that there wasn't really any point. Because if you think about the patient outcomes, whether you do it laparoscopically or vaginally, the patient outcomes are very similar. But you can tackle anything laparoscopically as opposed to vaginally. You kind of have to select patients a little bit more. And so I gradually just moved to 100% laparoscopic surgery. So, and I think that a lot of, especially if you're dealing with more challenging pathology, I think you need to be able to see. I think that adds so much to what you're dealing with. You can deal with endometriosis, complicated cysts, adhesions, much better than vaginally. And that's why, I think V-nodes is an interesting technology because it does combine the vaginal surgery and being able to see. So, and I think that is probably the key to allow more people to use that, you know, that access port. I don't know what you think, Dr. Surin.
Well, Nick, those points come together this way. First of all, full disclosure, of course, Dr. Einarsson doesn't do robotic surgery because he can do anything laparoscopically. And that is, that's not a joke, because he doesn't need anything else because he has a brilliant understanding of anatomy and decades of experience in thousands and thousands and thousands of cases. And we're talking about the great majority of gynecologists who don't. I mean, and the residents who finish now only have to do 15 vaginal hysterectomies to graduate, and they have a hard time scraping together that number. And they have to do, so the difficulty there really comes back to knowledge of anatomy. Now, in terms of visualization, Dr. Mohawad brings up a great point about obliterated cul-de-sac. Many people recommend actually a diagnostic laparoscopy before a lot of this is done. To know that what you're getting into before you get into it. Now, here's the controversy. If you do a vaginal surgery, why are you popping a laparoscope in there? But let's talk about that. In, I guess it was 1991, Stovall and Ling published a very excellent paper of 91 patients who were scheduled for vaginal hysterectomy, and only a few of them were thought to be candidates. But when they popped in the scope, fully 90% of them were able to be done vaginally because they had the confidence of knowing the anatomy. So that's really the elephant in the room here, which is anatomy. And unless people are trained, it doesn't matter what modality you use, you're going to be unable to do it. And unlike the other unfortunate circumstance we had, like vaginal mesh and all these other procedures where you'd have weekend warrior sessions where they would teach you how to do it, this is not something that you can just grab onto. Another thing is the definition of a high volume surgeon that's in the literature. A high volume surgeon is what, 10, 12 major cases a year, you know, one a month. I mean, I wouldn't get on an airplane with a pilot that only flew once a month. Why would you have surgery by somebody like that? So I think that what we're talking about is it's funneling these modalities. I think VNOTES is great. I think robotics is great. And I think laparoscopic surgery is great. But it needs to go into the right hands. And that is, I think, the key. Now, the next thing about that would be the expenses, you know, the cost versus the benefit. And again, I'm not nearly as conversant in that as Dr. Mohawad is. So maybe he can help us out with that.
I'm gonna talk a little bit about the very important aspect of robotic surgery, how it could help spread the robotic VNOTES. And then when we look and learn from the experience what robotic surgery did to open surgery or laparotomy, when we talk about hysterectomy, robotic surgery was able to shift most of the laparotomy into a minimally invasive where laparoscopy was steady. And this was shown clearly in a lot of the graphs that we have in one of our study, which is published in PLOS One about the movement to outpatient. And we can see that the laparoscopic surgery was steady from 2008 to 2016 in terms of percentage, and where robotic surgery, where we thought before it could take away from laparoscopic surgery, now it took from the laparotomy and shifted the more complex procedures done laparotomy to a minimally invasive option. And I think if we extrapolate those graphs, that might be the actual benefit what robotic surgery could do to the VNOTES, where it could shift a lot of the laparoscopic transabdominal or robotic transabdominal into a VNOTE modality. But eventually it's going to take a lot of learning. Now, in terms of cost, again, as most of the costs in the US, where we're talking the direct cost, comes from two things. Comes from the operative length, and then whenever you start being more efficient doing whichever modality is very important. It comes from the understanding of surgeon, how to use judiciously the instrument and not opening a million instrument where you can do the case simply with a normal electrosurgery. And the third thing, which the what we talk, we never talk about, it's not only the major part of the cost is the direct cost, the capital cost of robotic surgery, but it's the cost of complication, readmission, conversions, reoperation. This is what drives the major cost in the US for surgery. It might not be true for other countries, but this is the cost here. And enabling the more efficient surgeon using the appropriate tools with the right training, that's going to help driving the cost rather than the cost of the instrument they use, in the sense, rather than the total cost of care that we need to take a look at, and the opportunity cost, which is whatever the hospital can do with those resources that were not used if the patient was not admitted to the hospital, rather if the patient was discharged the same day with a minimally invasive surgery option. And this is the total cost that we need to look at mainly.
Let me just jump in here.
Can I actually ask a question here, Dr. Zerwin? Can you comment on the postoperative outcomes from the studies that were done on the 22 human specimens that you covered?
You mean from on the hominis?
Yes, on the hominis.
Yes, well, there were actually no postoperative complications or intraoperative ones. There was no cuff dehiscence, there were no fever, there were no bladder infections, there were no ureteral injuries. And these were done, the first initial ones were done by the expert surgeons, but then the site in Belgium used a fellow for several of the cases, and not only to look at the learning curve, but to see their ability to do it, and similar outcomes were achieved. I just wanted to just jump offline here for a second to riff off of what Dr. Moawad talked about, which is complications. And that comes into my concern about anatomy and patient volume. And again, we don't have to publish this part of it, but I just want to let you know. So I was last week in Atlanta with my son, who just started his urology practice, okay? And I went into the OR with him, and he was doing this really complicated nephrectomy with scarring, and everything was such a mess. And he did hundreds of robotic cases. He actually did more robotic cases than anybody in history in Julian University. And he just zipped right through it, and it was really good. We were gonna go out to lunch after that, and he was called into the OR by a gynecologist who was doing an open TAH and cut across the ureter. So he had to go in there and fix his ureter and do a ureteral implant. This is what I'm talking about. How can this happen? You know, I mean, this wasn't a bend. I said, was it a typical hysterectomy? He says, no, you know, a little fibroid. Okay, so what I think we really need, the issue that needs to be addressed is with any new technology. Look at what we got into with any modality from endometrial ablation to hysteroscopic sterilization to anything that we're doing mesh. Is that it's not the device itself, it's the operator, it's not the golf club that makes the problem, it's the person that swings the golf club, you know, that makes the score. In terms of postoperative complications with robotics, I think all three of us see medical legal cases that are related to robotic surgery, and most of them that I see are thermal injury. They're a burning of the bladder or the bowel or the ureter, and this is all related. I think that visualization is important, everything that we've discussed, but unless we properly train our surgeons, I'm just going right off the edge of the cliff here, okay? So unless we change our training programs, we're really going to see an acceleration of this problem, which is why when we adopt these pathologies, we need to put them in the hands of the people who can do it. In terms of Dr. Moawad's point about robotic V-notes, I think that's an excellent future for the specialty. It takes all advantages of the vaginal approach. all of the technical and engineering aspects of robotics, and as well as cost and recovery. Again, I just feel strong that it has to be directed or restricted to people who really, really know what they're doing. I will say, and finally, because I don't want to hog this whole thing, one of my other fellows, Dr. Guan, Shaman Guan, introduced V-notes and robotic V-note surgery into China, where it's really caught on very big, but it's a different market there. And it's a different group of surgeons, people who do thousands of cases, thousands and thousands of cases. So, I mean, that's my big picture take on this so far. I know we have to edit it down, but there we go.
Well, yeah, I think that if you think about what's most important, that's obviously patient outcomes. And what's the most important thing there? I agree with you that it probably is the surgeon volume. It's not whether they, which robot they're using or whether they're doing a laparoscopic or vaginal surgery. So of course, that should be the main focus. And I think my view on that is actually a little bit more optimistic, because I think what's going on is that more and more cases, especially in urban areas, are going to high volume providers. And because, you know, we've been graduating now a few hundred fellows in laparoscopic surgery or minimally invasive gynecologic surgery, and they're just gradually building their practice and taking more cases. And if you're a generalist and coming out, or an OBGYN specialist, I think is the right term to use, then your volume, surgical volume, is so low, and it's very hard for you to get, up to speed on that, that it's almost untenable in larger urban areas, and because high volume surgeons are doing more cases. And I think that translates into better outcomes to patients, which obviously is what we want. So I think that's happening, at least in urban areas. It's not as obvious in smaller communities, that's not as clear cut.
In this world of 2020 of fake news, okay. So what's the real news about costs of robotic surgery? If you mix the whole stew together with costs and morbidity and cost to the hospital and to the insurance system, I mean, what you'll have articles to say, oh yes, robotic surgery is less expensive. Some will say it's more expensive, and so on. So where are we?
So this is going to be always like who comes first, the chicken or the egg. Uh-huh. Because it's the same debate, and let me tell you why. All the studies have a major lack in the literature, which is we don't compare apple to apples and oranges to oranges. And this the whole issue emanates because we don't have a complexity score for a hysterectomy. So what we use as a proxy for complexity is the weight of the uterus, which we all know it's nonsense. Sometimes you can remove a kilogram uterus with an 800 pedunculated fibroid, and it will take you less than removing a 100 gram uterus with stage 4 endometriosis. And that was the proxy used. And the challenge with robotic surgery is we do not have a way to separate the learning curve of people, and not only the learning curve, because many people are lured that they will become expert surgeons if they do 20 cases of robotic. And this is probably some of the marketing tools to engage people. But the proficiency curve, which is around 100 cases, and the 100 cases to be met for surgeons who do even compared as high volume surgeon doing, 15 or 20 or 30, that's going to take them 3 or 4 years to get to that level. So we have a major issue in defining the complexity of a hysterectomy in when we do the study in assessing the surgeon's skills. And then it's all a mishmash, and then you want to come up with cost. Like in papers like Luciano and Lim, Luciano studied the Premier database and found that complication rate with despite obesity and with robotic surgery is lower than laparoscopic and open surgery. And then Lim, the same thing, but you have other studies like Jan studies in fertility and sterility, La Rose, or the other with Parezo, the sacrocolpopexia randomized trial. again, these are studies that shows that robot is more expensive and take longer time, and that's why it will be more costly. But in most of the study, there was no difference between the complication between laparoscopy and robotics. So I think having a laparoscopic surgeon spending 4 hours in the OR, where the cost of an OR minute in the US is $85, mm-hmm. is very different than having a robotic surgery doing the same surgery in 1 hour. So you're going to be way less expensive. So it's surgeon dependent mainly. If you have a laparoscopic surgeon admitting the patient overnight just because this is the practice, where a PACU minute costs $15 versus a robotic surgeon sending the patient home after 3 hours, that's going to be major difference in cost. Yeah. So there are practice dependent cost incurrences, surgeon skill dependent cost incurrences. And as you said before, the right tool is the right hand lead to the best outcome in terms not only, you know, financial wise, but also medical wise.
Can I kick it back to you, Jan and Gabi? I know you're minority, but I mean, what you mentioned all over was obesity. And yep. we just touched over it very briefly, but the transvaginal approach has definite advantages in morbidly obese patients. You don't need the steep Trendelenburg necessarily yep. that you do for robotics and so on and so on. And we don't really matter how that works. So I'd be interested to know your experience. And also, Jan, you deal with a lot of morbidly obese patients and also in your training program. How do you see, well, first for you, it's not going to be a challenge, but how do you see the people that you're training dealing with the epidemic of obesity and its relation to modality, laparoscopic, robotic, and vaginal?
Well, I just want to echo what Gabby was saying. I've now done a few randomized trials on robotic versus laparoscopic surgery, and we've done some retrospective and cohort studies. And you know, most of our studies are biased. I will admit that, because you know, I'm much more proficient laparoscopic surgeon than robotic surgeon, and I think that probably is true for most surgeons, that they have their modality that they're really, really good at, and then the other stuff they're not quite as good at. So it's hard to do randomized trials on surgical access, is just so, because the bias is always on the surgeon. So, you know, population-based studies or having groups that are really, really good at and in similar environments and comparing those outcomes are probably the least subject to bias, but it's not never going to be really perfect. In terms of obesity, I think, I mean, that's a little bit outside of the scope of this, but I'll offer a couple of things. I mean, I think obviously patient positioning is more, the bigger the patient, the more important that is. And again, a little bit outside the scope, but what I found helpful with laparoscopy over robotics and obese patients is that I have complete freedom to move the patient the way I want at any time during the surgery. So I like to put the patient in very, very steep Trendelenburg, like 30 degrees, pull the bowel away, and then move the patient back. And then until the bowel sort of starts to move down, but it's not in my way, and it's leave her there. And then you can always put her down flat if anesthesia is having a problem, and then go back. So sometimes you do have to maneuver that around. I know that there are obviously those tables that move with the robot, where you can move, you know, everything, and you have the same freedom. But not everybody, you know, has access to that. So that's one advantage. But I know a lot of people like robotics for obese patients, and they have different reasons. And maybe Gabby can elaborate on that.
For us, with the obesity is the advantage. You don't have the fulcrum effect from the thickness of the abdominal wall as you do in laparoscopy. And many times, of course, for more experienced surgeons, they can overcome this or overlook that. But many times, this is a challenge. Plus, most of the laparoscopic instruments, sometimes for extremely obese patients, start becoming a challenge, and you need to use bariatric because they don't get to where you are, where you want to be. And with obesity, the precise movement with the laparoscope will become, when we're dealing with way more complex cases, will become an issue. The assistant Because in laparoscopy, many times when you have a more complex case, you rely more on your assistant in the sense they have to do more active, being more actively engaged in the surgery rather than doing a simple case. You have to rely on the surgeons being ambidextrous for super complex cases where if the assistant cannot do the job on their side, they can move and be with the same efficiency with both hands. And these are challenges mitigated by robotic surgery. I think one of the values that nobody talks about in robotic surgery is how your assistant becomes less and less relied on throughout the procedure, where you can have three arms and a camera that you fully control, rather than at most two arms with laparoscopic surgery. And this is when one of the value, if we go back to the robotic V-node, one of the value that robotic could help overcoming the challenges of the traditional V-nodes with laparoscopy, because with obesity you have even limited more limited range of motion with less precision. With robotics, you can do with the wristed instrument more overcome this, the triangulation of surgery, and then the ease of access and visualization with the robotic versus laparoscopy for extremely obese patients. I don't know your experience, Dr. Zerwin, with the being overlooking the new robot. How do you find that would play a role?
With obesity?
Yes.
Well, most of these have been, the largest hysterectomy we've done is 15 weeks size, which is good enough. Even with some adhesions, but again, that is qualified by the fact that we looked in, you know, made sure that we wouldn't have any issues with that. The morbidly obese patient, we haven't really done, a lot, because they were European mainly, and they're of course thinner, but, the fact that they are, we have not had to put them in Steve Trendelenburg, and of course vaginally, it's a whole different world because of the way you position the patient, the bowel is normally out of the way, unless there are some adhesions that stick the bowel to the cul-de-sac. We haven't run into those problems, but a question back at you is for the robotic V-notes or any of your V-notes, but especially the robotic V-notes, don't you also pop a scope into the umbilicus and look before you do your V-notes, or are you just gonna go in there hoping that we don't have a deep infiltrating endometriosis?
Well, I don't do V-notes, but I think this is the access is gonna be the main issue. And not only that, the access, even for the most experienced vaginal surgeon, if they're gonna do V-note, this is a completely whole new perspective of anatomy they need to be familiarized with. Because when they did vaginal surgery, they went by feel. They didn't go by look.
Right.
And then even for the laparoscopic surgeon, seeing anatomy in reverse is gonna be also something that they need to be accustomed to, and they need to know the different view of the different landmark. Because now as a laparoscopic surgeon, when you look at from open surgery, you start feeling the difference how much you're more comfortable doing laparoscopy and finding the ureter than when you're looking above to an open incision, especially for challenging cases. So I think the type of pelvis, nobody talks about it in pelvic surgery. And I think that's going to be one of the major determinants in the success of V-nodes. Because if you have a platypeloid pelvis where the pubis bone is very close to the coccyx, then the range of motion of the straight stick instrument doing V-node is going to be way more challenging to do more complex cases. If you have an android pelvis, that's going to be a deeper pelvis that requires bigger instrument to reach the landmark that you're going to do. So there are a lot of learning, and I think we go back to the same thing where we thought it should be done by expert surgeon before we can find the standardization of triage, because triaging patients to V-node is going to be the main issue, and using triage kind of standardized tool to increase the success of that surgery and minimize the complication would be key.
Okay, so just to step off from that point, where do you guys see V-Notes and the Omnis robot, you know, enter clinical practice? Where are they? Where are these things going to be useful? I mean, Rob, I know that most of your trials or studies have been on hysterectomy, but I'm sure that this could be used on other things as well. And I know V-Notes is being used for sacral colpopexies and ovarian cysts, et cetera, et cetera. So where do you see this sort of vaginal robotic access fit into clinical practice?
Well, in the study that we have, I'm just pulling it up really quick.
January 2020, Jan Bakeland, and then the crew from Israel.
Whoa. Sorry, let me pull that down. Sorry. Sorry about that. They actually did add nexectomies, including a ovarian cysts in the hominis trial, and also adhesions and fibroids and prolapse. So those are pretty well established. And the FDA, we're waiting on doing a whole more series of cases until that goes through. But cases like sacral colpopexies, well, remember you've got a colpotomy. And so just by that nature, it makes it a little harder to do sacral colpopexies with that robot because it goes in and then kind of goes around 180 degrees. And so that really hasn't been tried yet. I think where though it's utility is going to be proven is cost. It's a small, portable, inexpensive robot for at least at this point cases that are don't need a bigger, more platform. Also, in future iterations, it'll be used for other surgical devices, cases besides gynecology, head and neck surgery, and so on. But in keeping to the GYN area. Keeping to the GYN area, I think that it's going to find its niche in people who have had challenges in doing vaginal surgery and helping them enter into the world of vaginal surgery, because entry into the peritoneal cavity is easy and dissection is easy, and it allows them to use a vaginal approach, but with much better visualization. And I think that's going to be where it starts. Then when version 2.0 or 3.0 comes out, there'll be more indications. But I think it'll encourage people to go back into that vaginal surgery is the preferred method of gynecologic surgery.
I have a safety point to raise here. I think it might be valuable for our discussion. So I know the importance of V-Notes, and most of the trials on V-Notes were done on a fairly limited number of cases. But the safety question that I raise is the differences between clean surgeries and clean contaminated surgery in terms of infection rate is higher. And whenever we open the vagina, that's now we shifted in a nexectomy, which is a clean surgery done laparoscopically, to a clean contaminated surgery done with V-Notes. So does that offer an advantage, especially for patients with fertility issue, like doing a myomectomy? If she had a pelvic infection, that means like we're gonna ruin out the rest of that. So that's the point that I would like to bring in when we shift clean surgery to clean contaminated. Is that worth the risk of infection?
That's a good point. I mean, from my perspective, when we do myomectomies, for example, ACOG does not recommend antibiotics for myomectomies, but we do it on all cases because you don't know when you're gonna enter the cavity, which happens, 10, 15% of the time. And then it's basically an open access. And we did a study at the Brigham, it was published in the Green Journal a couple of years ago, showing that there was a statistically significantly increased risk of infections in patients that did not get antibiotics and myomectomy. It was a retrospective study, not randomized. So we need a randomized trial. But yes, it's a good point. I think that if you do enter into the vagina, I would say you probably need antibiotic prophylaxis. And even in that setting, could you introduce some things that you wouldn't otherwise? Time will tell, I guess, but yeah. Theoretically possible. All right. Well, we're almost wrapping up, but I think like maybe talk a little bit about training. So how do you guys feel about surgical training? We touched on this a little bit before, but what should you, I know that robotic surgery, the traditional robotic surgery, we've had, so most hospitals have limits. You have to do a certain amount of cases before you can, use it. And then you have to do a certain amount of cases to maintain your skills. Maybe Gabby, you can comment a little bit on that. And then Rob, if you could say a few words about what you think will happen with this new modality.
So for training, there are a pathway that should be followed before you start using the robot. And it differs like locally by different hospitals. First thing is that you need to finish an online training where you get to get familiar with the robot and then how to use it. And then there are, animal labs that you have to go through, then cadaveric lab, the third step. And then after that, depending on the hospital, each hospital mandates 3 to 5 cases to be proctored by somebody else. And many hospitals says that you need to do between 12, 15, and sometimes 20 robotics a year to maintain your privileges in a hospital doing robotic surgery every year. I think there is no clear guidelines and there's no data behind that, but this is most of a standard of care that everybody copy and paste through different. And again, that takes us back to the main issue is robotic is not a modality. Robotic is a tool. So if you do laparoscopic surgery, if you do robotic, or if you do any other surgery, there are more important criteria that are not regulated, which is the skills, as you mentioned before, which is the training required, the number of cases maintained. So these are the main issue, but for the current now standard of use of the robotic, these are the things that many people do in their hospitals.
With regard specifically to the Hominis platform, we've already developed a training model so that you will have extensive experience on, and actually a new company coming through that has very lifelike anatomy to practice on that. And so that's certainly an advance. I think many of the companies do something like that. We have our own proprietary training system. However, I think that anatomy itself, just fundamental anatomy, cadaver work or actually scrubbing, and certainly in the residency program, scrubbing with a competent MIG surgeon who will take them through pelvic sidewall dissection and so that they're able to find the ureter no matter what, or get the uterine artery no matter what. And they have to, I'd like to see them show proficiency in doing that. I don't think that, I've always been critical about the criteria for the number of cases when, here we go again, with the AHL came out with this in 2013, 2014, for 25 cases a year. In my hospital, what would happen is you'd get around December, right? And so there were a couple of three or four cases short of the 25 robotic cases they need. So they do robotic tubal ligations. And they do robotic diagnostic laparoscopies just to have a robotic case. I mean, this is like the Wild West. And so nobody can, as I agree with Dr. Mowat, there's no agreed upon protocol. And I go back with him. It's up to the ethical standards of the individual surgeon to feel that they have competence in doing it. Now, in terms of a hospital determining what is competence, I throw up my hands. I don't know if there's any real good objective test because, you could do 100 cases. It reminds me when I was training and they'd say, you could do 100 cases, but you can do them wrong, so that doesn't mean volume alone.
What I noticed when I went to Europe a lot, that the advantage what they do during the learning curve is two surgeons scrub. But here the health system it will be very costly if they can do that kind of thing here. They would never allow two surgeons all the time to scrub until they meet their proficiency levels. So I don't know. There are a lot of constraints from the health system, from the way everything is set. It's not an ideal world.
Nope. Very true.
I mean,
all right. Should we end it here? Do you want to say some final things, or are you good with this?
It's really good. I think that it will encourage people to rethink our whole approach to surgery, really, in GYN world, because as we come out with more and more different technologies, no matter what they are, hysteroscopic morcellators, lasers, I mean, they can come out with whatever gizmo that they can. I think that it all boils down to the training programs. And again, going back to vaginal surgery, well, even back to the old days of forceps, you know, the people who could do them, they're dead or retired, you know, and the people who do vaginal surgery, like you were mentioning, Jan, you did 50, 60 vaginal hysterectomies. I can't imagine that many programs are doing that, you know, or that there are any faculty left that can do that. So I think we just have to retool our whole training program, which is not a very viable idea. But in terms of this particular topic, that technologies are coming through that will facilitate the ability of those with general knowledge of surgery to approach surgery safer and more cost effective, and make it more accessible to them to do these kind of procedures.
Maybe we can throw in something about that will make the article always appealing. We can throw in something that hopefully that artificial intelligence and machine learning could help us create algorithm to understand more triaging patients to different modality of surgery, whether vaginal or laparoscopic. And that could be something really cool about to mention. Because at the end of the day, we don't need to glorify another robot. We need to improve the innovative aspect of how the robot or the computer-assisted surgery can help the surgeon standardizing the outcome of the surgery, rather than relying on a human to make decision making.
Right. I think that's a good. Those are good. You know, those are. I mean, what we talked about before. That important thoughts to end on is that it's at the end of the day, it's the surgeon's skill that is the most important. And you know, we often forget that when we talk about it. That is the most important ingredient.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PAP Talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.